Starting quarter three, I'm going to do a class on global Christianity. And so I just wanted to just give them kind of a little, I guess, overview of the class. Just touch on a couple of the topics we'll be discussing in the class. And I don't know, just hopefully convince some of you that, hey, this would be something interesting. This would be something worth, you know, spending a quarter reading and getting into and digging into a little bit. So like I said, it's going to be real brief. I'm just going to like kind of brush over a lot of the topics we're going to be looking at. So yeah, we're just going to go ahead and dive right into it. We're going to kind of be looking at two different perspectives this morning. We'll start off just looking from a biblical perspective. Why Christianity on a global scale is something that's worth our attention, something that is biblical, something that's, not just, you know, pull out a couple verses here and there, but it's something that on a grand scale is just really threaded throughout the whole Bible. And then we're going to kind of switch gears after that. We're going to look at kind of more of a, I don't know what you want to call it, maybe a, more of a demographic perspective. We're going to look at just some trends in society today, just some things that are kind of on a global scale, kind of going on in the world of Christianity in general, and just kind of see how that relates to us here in Wichita. So yeah, I guess kind of the question we're wanting to answer, the question we're going to look at, I guess two questions, is just one, why should we be interested in this? You know, is this, I mean, beyond just an intellectual curiosity, is this something that really is worth our time? Is this something that's really, you know, something we should be proactively seeking? That we should be learning about believers in other countries, not just learning about them on just a, you know, just a head knowledge level, but connecting with them, really having a communication and an intimacy with them? And should that be something where you would be actively pursuing in the seed as well? I mean, should we be interested that there's a diversity within the seed, you know, a racial and ethnic diversity, and also, you know, a socioeconomic diversity? Should we be interested in the seed really representing a larger slice of our society than just a small corner of it? So these are kind of the questions we're going to look at. These are definitely the questions we'll be looking at in the book or during the quarter three class. And yeah, let's jump right in. We're going to start off, and like I said, we're going to be looking at kind of a biblical perspective, first of all. And I think, you know, honestly, the second half of the sermon, we're going to talk a lot about some statistics and some numbers and some, we're going to pull out, you know, the Pew Research people and blah, blah, blah. And it's all, I mean, I think it's really fun. It's really interesting. But even if none of that existed, I think just the biblical perspective we're going to look at now kind of stands on its own. It gives enough weight to the importance of this that, that's why I wanted to start off with this. So one of the things we're going to look at is that, I've been reading through John recently and, you know, in the Last Supper, he's there praying with his disciples. You know, in John, we see a lot of just a real intimate prayer that we don't see in some of the other Gospels. And in John 17, you know, he's praying for his disciples, praying for all believers, praying for those who will come to be believers. And there's just this word that just keeps popping up. It's unity. Just keeps harping on this, that they may be one as I am one, that they may be one as you and I, Father, are one. He just repeats this over and over and over. Let's look at a couple of verses here. John 17, 11. Like, it should probably be up on the screen, but if not, you can pull it up in your Bibles there. John 17, 11. This is Christ. This is prayer at the Last Supper, praying to his Father, knowing what's about to happen. And he says, "And I am no longer in the world, but they are in the world, and I'm coming to you. Holy Father, keep them in your name, which you have given me, that they may be one, even as we are one." A little bit later on in this prayer, we're going to jump up to verses 20 through 22. Now he's kind of just praying for the community of believers in general. He says, "I do not ask for these only, but also for those who will believe in me through their word, that they may all be one, just as you, Father, are in me and I am in you, that they may also be in us, so that the world may believe that you sent me. The glory that you have given me, I have given to them, that they may be one, even as we are one." And he kind of keeps going back to this theme of that there may be unity, that they may be one. So I think he's putting such a high emphasis on this just because I think he kind of realizes that, of course he realizes, he's wanting to communicate that he's leaving the world, kind of his face in the world now is going to be through the church. And he knows that there's going to be lots of different facets of society that are now all expected to be just bundled into one thing, which is the church. There's going to be Jews, there's going to be people who come from the Roman, Greek, Hellenistic culture. There's going to be people who are extremely wealthy, people who are extremely poor. And he recognizes that all of these people now, who now all accept Christ, who all are now under the dominion of him, are all together now. So I think he spent a lot of emphasis on just this, that they may be one, that there may be unity. Because that he recognizes, and the expectation and the reality is that the church is really going to encompass all of these people. There's not going to be a church over here for the Jews, but they don't really get along with these folks over here, so they're going to make their own church over here. And the rich people don't really like hanging out with the poor people, so we got 12 different churches all in this one. No, he recognizes that all those who claim the name of Christ, we are together as one body. So he's praying for unity because the reality is the expectation is that there's one body, that this body encompasses lots of different people from lots of different backgrounds, lots of different life experiences, lots of different races, lots of different socioeconomic statuses, so on and so forth. And we kind of know this, we see this kind of rubbing up against each other throughout the rest of the New Testament. You know, that's why we see this situation where Paul has to kind of get up in Peter's face about, you know, the way he's behaving in the church, you know, because there's the Jews who kind of had this idea that, you know, they kind of wanted to hold to some of their old traditions, so they don't really like, I mean, the non-Jewish people are in our church, you know, we've got to accept it, but we just don't really like it that much, you know. And so the Jews are always kind of pressuring him, you know, they're going to be here, but you don't need to sit down and eat with them at the same table, I mean, for crying out loud, you know. And Peter kind of gives into the pressure a little bit, you know, and Paul, when he comes and sees what's going on, I mean, that's why we see that confrontation in Galatians 2. He kind of has to get up in his face about it a little and say, like, no, you're being a hypocrite. And there's lots of other examples, and we see Paul always charging Timothy to you know, not let people who are giving these false teachings of, you know, maintaining the whole law, not to give in to them. We see kind of this tension throughout the Bible because we know that the reality is that the church is really supposed to be encompassing everybody. We're not splitting up into kind of the social constructs that we have and everybody's divvying out and, okay, now we're just got these people and I'm, okay, I like all these people. Everybody in my church I like and everybody I don't like is in a different place, so now we're good, you know. So that's why there's just this emphasis on unity, I think, really, in Christ's prayer in John 17. Another aspect, I think, in the Bible, this is really kind of more of an Old Testament thing, is just this emphasis on the word they use, at least in the ESV, is sojourner. You know, I think some other ones translate it as foreigner. I think even a word we could probably use is just immigrant. All throughout the Bible, the Old Testament particularly, this concept just keeps coming up. You know, in the Old Testament, God really revealed himself and communicated to the world through Israel. He specifically selected that nation. That's where he operated. But he recognized that within Israel, within this, you know, this square space of land that was Israel, there was going to be a lot of people living there that weren't technically Israelites. They were going to be, what the word they use here is sojourner, people kind of who've come into your land, who are passing through your land, who are here for a while or maybe even here permanently, but aren't really of your blood, aren't really from your, you know, aren't Israelites per se. And it's just kind of interesting, it's just sprinkled all throughout the Old Testament, just his, okay, recognizes they're here, now how are you supposed to treat them? What's the relationship you're supposed to have with them? When I kind of was, you know, researching this a little bit, there was like 50 verses that kind of dealt with this. I picked two or three. If you're interested in reading more of them, I mean, holler at me, I can let you know some. But I picked two or three that I think are just kind of specifically relevant here. One is Exodus 22:21. This is when we're laying out the law, you know, how Israelites are supposed to relate to God, relate to one another. Exodus 22:21 says, "You shall not wrong a sojourner or oppress him, for you were once sojourners in the land of Egypt." As he's saying, hey, there's people amongst you in Israel who aren't really from your nation. How are you supposed to treat them? Do not oppress them. Remember that you used to be once immigrants, foreigners in other lands. So treat them, you know, treat them the way you want to be treated. Deuteronomy 1:16. It's kind of giving a charge here to judges, how they're supposed to deal out justice to the nation. It says, "And I charged your judges at that time, hear the cases between your brothers and judge righteously between a man and his brother or the alien who's with him." So again, God's just kind of laying out, you know, if you have foreigners in your land, as you're settling disputes, trying to figure stuff out, judge justly, judge righteously between your brothers and these other people over here who aren't technically part of your land. Judge justly between them as well. Look at one more. In Ezekiel 47:21-23, it's kind of discussing how land will be divided out in the New Jerusalem. It says, so you shall divide this land among you according to the tribes of Israel. You shall allot it as an inheritance for yourselves and for the sojourners who reside among you and have had children among you. They shall be to you as native-born children of Israel. With you they shall be allotted an inheritance through the tribes of Israel. In whatever tribe the sojourner resides, there you shall assign him his inheritance, declares the Lord God. Basically saying, you know, if you've got people living among you, they've got their families, you're to treat them as native-born sons of Israel. When you're dividing up the land, if this guy's working here, if he lives here, if he's got his farm, whatever here, then that's his now. So I picked out, just like I said, two or three, but there's literally just a list. It's just something that throughout the Old Testament is just kind of, God just continues to kind of remind the Israelites, just to kind of focus on. There's just this emphasis, this underlying emphasis on it, saying, you know, you are to be interested. You are to be respectful. You are to treat these people as your own people. You know, there's not this, I don't want a bunch of divisions. I don't want, well, these people are not technically Israelites, so you get the rocky, trashy land over there. No, saying you are to treat them as native Israelites. Kind of just see this thread throughout the Old Testament of this. And so I think kind of the same, I mean, we should kind of take that to heart, you know. If there's obviously just this kind of importance that just underlies so much of the law on this, and I think we should probably say, well, this is obviously maybe a value that Christ values, that we should also be interested in, that the community of Christians amongst us, that we should be interested in, you know, really encompassing everybody. And one last one, and this is, you know, just real brief. I mean, just looking at the great chapter of Revelation 7, you know, I mean, honestly, just simply, in heaven, there's no more social constructs. There's no more social classes or divisions of, you know, wraiths or ethnicity. I mean, got this great scene in Revelation 7, 9 through 10, where it says, "And I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number from every nation, from all the tribes and all people and all languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, 'Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb.'" So this is just a reality in heaven as well. The brief moments that we live here on earth, you know, we are very divided up in a lot of senses, but that's not really going to be reality in heaven. This is something that God is obviously, he all people stand before the throne, and there's not any preferences, there's not any special, you know, there's not any special allotments for anyone at that point, for rich or for poor, for, you know, for white or for black, for anybody. It's just all stand before the throne. And it's made it very clear in the Bible too that he's called people from all nations. That there's not, well, I've got a quota of a lot of you and then I'm going to pick two or three of you. No, he has called people from all nations, from all tribes, from all tongues. So I think if there's just kind of this underlying, and like I said, we just picked out a couple examples. We could go into a lot more of this in depth, but I think if there's just kind of this underlying just kind of thread throughout all of Scripture on just this concept of all nations, all tribes, all tongues. We really see it starting in the Old Testament law and all the way to Revelation, where all believers are together worshiping Christ in heaven. I think if there's just kind of this underlying thread of it, I think that we should take that to heart, that this is a biblical value. This isn't just a value that our culture holds. Because, I mean, certainly diversity and tolerance and et cetera, is a value that our culture holds. I think we can all, anyone who's watched a commercial or, I don't know, gone to any type of public school knows that we get a lot of that this is something of high value from our culture. But I think this is also a biblical value. I think we should also take this to heart in a biblical light as well. Like I said, if we just kind of see this really throughout all of the Bible, and this is something that we should say, hey, you know what? I want to see this, I want to promote this within Christianity as well. I want to have connections with believers who are very different from myself, from other nations. I want to see within my own church body people from lots of different backgrounds, lots of different socioeconomic statuses. I want this diversity that Christ is obviously, that the Bible is pushing and promoting and putting value on. I want to have value on this in my body as well. And honestly, I mean, I think that, and just as an aside, I think there's really one of the most compelling things that the church can communicate to the world is when there are a lot of people that don't have a lot in common, and we all stand together locked in arms, and we all say, hey, we've all bought into the gospel. We don't share a culture. We don't share history. We don't share languages. We in no other situation would have anything to do with one another, but we're all together because we've all bought into this thing that is the gospel. I think there's few things, personally, that are more compelling than when the church really communicates that to the world. I mean, just even looking back to Christ's prayer in John 17, he's always praying for unity, that they may be one, Father, as we are one. But he always ties it back to this. He always says, so that they may believe that you have sent me. He's always praying for unity, not just because it gives them a warm fuzzy inside, like, oh, this is so nice, we're all holding hands. No, he's saying, I want there to be unity in the body because it communicates, it lets the world know that you have sent me. That it communicates a reality that Christ is real. And that if there is something that's very different, that our little community here is in a very marked way different than our larger community around us, and that really communicates that, oh, well, there is something, obviously, there is some underlying power moving within us. It's not just within other civics groups and community groups and things of that nature. So, like I said, this is just a very brief kind of biblical overview, I think, of why this is something that we should value, why this is something we should be interested in, that why we should be interested in promoting a very diverse group, a very diverse body. And that this is not something that we should, well, just on a philosophical level, yeah, that's great, but it's something we should actively be looking for within our own body as well. So we're going to kind of switch gears a little bit now, and I'm going to take a drink. We're going to kind of look at more of a, I guess, kind of demographic statistics, kind of some cultural trends going on around the world. I don't know what else to call it. There's probably a good one word that encapsulates all of that, but I couldn't think of it. So Christianity is really growing, I mean, massively in a lot of places. And I'm guessing, I mean, I certainly don't, and I'm assuming that a lot of us wouldn't really associate as being places of large Christian growth, as strong Christian communities, of really strongholds of the faith. Really in the past, I don't know how many years, but recently it's really just started to grow in areas that I'm guessing if we throw out there, if you heard this, you'd be like, oh, I wouldn't have thought of that. So if I were to throw out there, if I were to ask you, you know, what are some, you know, just around the world, what are some areas that we would consider like kind of strongholds of Christianity, where Christianity is really just rooted and the church is strong and built up? I'm sure a lot would say, well, probably the United States, and we all live here, there's a lot of churches here, you know. And after that, we might be like, oh, I don't know, maybe somewhere in Europe, maybe, I don't know. I mean, a lot of the fathers of the faith came from there, so I guess, you know, I mean, that's where Luther and Calvin, a lot of these guys came from, so probably there, I don't know. But if I threw out words like Nigeria, the Philippines, China, I'm guessing these probably weren't like at the top of our list, right? Yeah, okay, well, so much for my surprise, huh? Yeah, these are just people just right now, nowadays, who would self-identify themselves as, I'm a believer, you know. These aren't like huge countries. I mean, you could fit the whole country of Nigeria in like half of Texas, probably. But there's 78 million people in Nigeria, 86 million in the Philippines, and a very conservative estimate in China, although, I mean, we can't really know for certain. There's just, you know, they don't have statistic, well, anyway, that's a whole different story. But in China, you know, a very conservative estimate would be 68 million, probably more. So these are pretty substantial numbers, and these are all larger numbers of people who self-identify, say that I'm a Christian, than we see in any European country nowadays. More than places like France, the United Kingdom, Italy, which is, you know, the home of Roman Catholicism. There are more people in Nigeria, the Philippines, and China who say that I'm a believer than would self-identify in any of those, in any country in Europe. So I just think that there's just kind of this slow growth. I would say slow. There's been a slow demographic change in Christianity recently that's really kind of changing the face of Christianity. Places that for years have really been associated with Christianity, it's really kind of waning, and people are kind of saying, like, kind of checking out of it, like, I'm done. And in places that, you know, maybe 100 years ago we read these exotic novels about missionaries going in there and there was nobody, now are, you know, obviously strongholds of Christianity, have millions and millions of believers, have churches that are being planted and grown on a rapid scale daily, and not really tied to any missionaries as well. They're just, you know, they're supporting themselves. It is just its own indigenous growth now. This is really just something in numbers as well. What kind of, I mean, we can look at these numbers and say, okay, that's great, that's nice, but let's look at kind of an overall trend of kind of what Christianity is looking like and what it will look like in the next 50 years. Got one you can throw up there for me, Charisse. Yeah. And this is stuff I just pulled straight from the Pew Research people. They're like kind of one of the big polling centers, you know. I mean, it's not just some crazy website I went to and pulled this down. I mean, I'm hoping that these are legitimate statistics, so. Pew Research, they always put out these big reports on just any type of demographics, you know, whether it's just, you know, population growth or economic growth. But one thing they always do, they always have a big section in their reports on religion as well. So one thing I pulled out of the report says, atheists and agnostics and other people who do not affiliate with any religion, though increasing in countries such as the USA and France, will make up a declining share of the world's total population. Basically what it's saying there is every year as they run their little statistics, there's more people in the United States and lots of places in Europe who say, I'm an atheist, I'm an agnostic, you know, I'm just kind of done with this Christian thing. Yet at the same time, there's fewer and fewer people around the globe and everywhere else who's saying that I'm an atheist, I'm agnostic. So we kind of see this reversal trend here, right? Places like that have for a long time been strongholds of Christianity kind of starting to wane. Places that have for a long time not had much Christian history or tradition starting to grow. Got another statistic we can throw up there. Here we go. Once again, just from the Pew Research people. So the United States Christians will decline from more than 75% of the population in 2010 to 67% in 2050. So, you know, 2050, which is within our lifespan, you know, it's going to drop around 10%. Around 10% less of Americans will identify themselves as believers. So we're looking at about basically a third of the United States will say, like, this isn't my thing. I'm done with this. Okay, go on to the next one. Sub-Saharan Africa's Christian population is expected to double from 517 million in 2010 to 1.1 billion in 2050. So at the same time as we kind of see it waning, we're seeing that it's obviously growing massively in other places. So, okay, these are interesting statistics. I mean, it's all fascinating. We can say, okay, that's interesting. But I think what I'm trying to communicate here is that just the center of Christianity, which is for a long time, the United States, it's been Europe, is just kind of slowly starting to shift. Just a lot of, you know, Christianity is, it's kind of home, it's, you know, base, it's, you know, base camp for a long time in the United States and Europe, and it's kind of slowly kind of starting to move away from that. There are just fewer and fewer people in our society who are buying into Christianity, and there are more and more in other places in Europe, in Latin America, in Asia, and Africa who are buying into it. The center of global Christianity is kind of starting to move to we're just going to call it the global south. It's just a term that kind of historians have used to kind of describe, you know, kind of the non-Western world, Asia, Africa, Latin America. So it's just kind of slowly starting to shift to some of these places. So I guess if it's only slowly starting to shift, what does that really mean for us in the American church? I mean, most of the statistics they're throwing up there were, you know, all stuff within our life. I mean, we're talking about from here to 2050. I hope I'm still alive in 2050, you know. So this is probably something that's going to be, you know, we're going to see marked change, like actual physical, on-the-ground, tangible change in our life. So what does that mean for us? I mean, what does that mean kind of in tangible terms? We can say we've seen a bunch of numbers. Okay, it's growing in one place, not growing in another place. Great. But what does that kind of look like? What does that look like for the face of Christianity kind of on a global scale? Well, I think one thing we kind of assume is that as Christianity grows in other countries that aren't the United States, kind of their traditions, their theology, the defining aspects of Christianity for them really kind of start to define Christianity on a global scale. When people think of Christianity, I think nowadays they probably think of kind of American Christianity, maybe even European Christianity. I think it's kind of what kind of comes to mind as a overall, you know, picture of what Christianity looks like. But as it really kind of starts to just kind of fade here and grow in other places, kind of the face of Christianity is going to kind of start to look like what it is in a lot of those countries. So what does it look like? What does Christianity look like in other countries? Does it look just like it is here? I mean, does everybody meet in high schools and play acoustic guitars, and I don't know, whatever we do, stuff like that. I'm going to try to make some very, very sweeping generalizations. So if I say anything and you're like, wait a minute, I've been to a church somewhere else and it didn't look like that, I recognize that. I'm going to try to synthesize in 3 minutes, you know, what Christianity looks like abroad. So take this all with a grain of salt. If you're interested in looking at this, like I say, we're going to go into a lot more depth of this in the class. The book's got lots of pages devoted to kind of these topics. So if there's something that kind of piques your curiosity, I encourage you to take the class. Right now, since I've got, what, like 30 minutes or 45 minutes, I'm going to try to just really make some very broad generalizations. But what does Christianity look like abroad? What is it kind of, as Christianity grows and starts to define, as this traditions of Christianity kind of starts to define global Christianity, what does it look like? Well, churches abroad tend to be quite a bit more, I'm just going to use the word conservative, for lack of kind of a better word. Maybe traditional is a better word. You know, I think in kind of American culture, kind of an ideal we have is we try to kind of reflect our culture. You know, we dress like our culture, speak like our culture. We try to kind of infiltrate it and kind of redeem it from within. You know, we make art and music and things like that that reflect our culture, right? This just isn't really as much of a characteristic of Christianity around the world. They're not really that concerned with being just like otherworldly and like radically different and unrecognizable from their culture. They're not really as concerned being kind of like those weird Christians. And I think we'd all kind of like, we'd immediately kind of think like, well, that's not really a very good strategy, right? I mean, none of us here are very, you know, compelled by the weirdo Christians who act weird and talk weird and use a bunch of Christianese language. We're kind of like, that's a failed strategy, obviously, in the United States. So why would churches abroad be doing that? We're going to get into that. We'll look into that a little bit. But I mean, regardless of kind of our opinion of it, you know, it's been giving them pretty good results. Churches abroad have been growing by, I mean, millions and millions in the past, you know, 10, 20, 30 years. And something we've also got to kind of keep in mind is that, you know, when a lot of people from other cultures convert to Christianity, it's a much larger jump for them. They're coming from societies and traditions and cultures that don't really have a lot of Christian history, kind of Christian, kind of the society isn't founded upon Christian traditions and values and whatever. And so when they make a jump, it's a lot bigger jump than a lot of us are making. So we can kind of expect that they're going to also have to just be, it's really going to, like in a very real, painful way, impact every facet of their life. And so when we see that, like, you know, they are very much almost kind of removed and kind of just unrecognizable from their culture, then that's just kind of some of the realities that come along with this. So, one, it's just kind of, it's a lot more, like I said, maybe traditional, maybe conservative. Another one, there's a lot more of a supernatural bent in a lot of churches outside of Europe and the United States. United States culture and philosophy is really born out of the Enlightenment. Enlightenment, you know, was a movement in Europe where put a huge emphasis on logic, on reason, on scientific proof. And so that really is just kind of, that's kind of where our, you know, kind of American philosophy comes out of, you know. I think any one of us, if we hear anything that's like even remotely like supernatural, like immediately our skepticism kind of just turns on, like, whoa, that's not real. Like, I know immediately when I hear something that like somebody would say like, oh, this, I was supernaturally healed or this, I'm like, I'm thinking back in my mind, like, that's bunk. Like, that's just something he invented in his mind. And I think that's just kind of birthed out of kind of our culture. It's just, we have a very, I mean, we're just very logical, very rational. And that's why we make, and that's why we have giant 900 page books of systematic theology, because we like our theology systematic. I like it to be A, B, C, D with subpoint B, D, G, E. And I can read it all and figure it all out and like, boom, this is how God works. I've got this 900 page novel and everything. It's a system, right? There's nothing wrong with that. I've got one of those books at home. I read it every once in a while, you know. It's just kind of a representation of our culture. And I'm not here to dog on that. I like that stuff too. But a lot of other, the global South, their culture really doesn't have these strong Enlightenment ties that our culture does. They live in cultures that put a lot more emphasis on just kind of the spiritual world and just supernatural. And so they're pretty comfortable with, you know, a lot of the just very supernatural aspects we see in the Bible. You know, as we read through the Old Testament or the New Church and the New Testament, we see like healings and prophecies and exorcising of demons. I think I'm kind of like, this is so, I don't see any of that. What is this? Can we get on to something different? Like it just rubs up against our culture in a very uncomfortable way. A lot of these people come from cultures where that is a kind of a reality. And so a lot of cultures abroad from the global south will see have a lot more of a supernatural bent. So I'm guessing that probably as we're kind of reading this, you're like, well, I don't like any of that. Like, I think those are both very bad things, you know. I think we just got to kind of, that's certainly the first thing that kind of sprouts up in me as I'm reading this. I'm like, well, what? These people are all crazy. Like, why would they be doing this stuff? I think that's just one thing as we kind of go through the book. We have to just kind of take with a grain of salt, you know, that they're going to be some major, we're looking at cultures that just aren't ours, you know. And we're going to have to just, we're just going to have to really hash through it. But, I think it's a worthwhile endeavor. I think that the church is just growing by leaps and bounds in places that aren't here, you know. I think there are just more and more everyday believers that aren't from here. And I think it's a worthwhile endeavor to say, you know, we want to commune with these churches as well. We want to know what church is like. We want to know what the body of Christianity is like, just not here in Wichita, outside of just here in Wichita. So we've had a lot of statistics. We've had a lot of, you know, kind of global talk, you know, about this is what it looks like abroad. But I'm guessing probably a lot of you are thinking like, well, you know, I live in Wichita, Kansas. Like, I don't live in Nigeria or the Philippines. You know, heck, maybe some of you are kind of like, in 2050, I won't even be around anyway, so I'm checking out, you know. But I'd like to argue this is also these trends are also very real in Wichita as well. This isn't just like some overarching philosophical conversation we're having here. This is, I think, an on-the-ground reality in Wichita as well. I just pulled this straight out of the Wichita Eagle, and they just pulled this straight out of the U.S. Census data. There we go. In the 70s, Wichita's population was 87% white. Today, Wichita's population is 65% white, Hispanics making up 15%, and Asians making up 5%. So just from the 70s until now, which is like, what, 40 years? Yeah, 40-ish years. It's a 20%+ drop in just the, you know, white guys like me, you know, population. At the same time, you know, around 20% is people that are, you know, we traditionally, you know, associate with like immigrant populations, Hispanics, Asians. And this is, like I said, this is in 40 years. Now let's just compress this a little bit. Just in the last 10 years, like if you want to pull up the next slide there, just in the last 10 years, what has kind of the growth trends looked like? There we go. In the last decade alone, the Hispanic population in Wichita grew by 59% and the Asian population grew by 45%. So I think we can kind of see the future trends. So this isn't really just a out there, otherworldly, abstract, doesn't affect us kind of thing. I think this is obviously an on-the-ground reality in Wichita as well. The face of Wichita is changing a whole lot as well. All these, you know, global conversations that we just had, I think are playing out in our little city of Wichita as well. So as more and more people move into Wichita and from other nations, other backgrounds, other cultures, I think we can kind of associate or we can kind of assume that kind of the church, the Christian church within Wichita will also start to kind of reflect some of these things that we were discussing. It'll obviously just start to have a more diverse makeup. I think maybe, 40, 50 years ago, I'm pretty sure that every church in Wichita was probably Southern Baptist except for probably maybe two or three, you know, outlying Presbyterian churches or something like that. Obviously, I'm just making a large exaggeration, you know. But, we're going to just start seeing a lot of churches that are just very, very different, very diverse. So, what does that mean for us? Why should we be concerned with this? Well, I think if us as the seed church wants to be relevant in the long term, then we need to know how to really address and adopt and be a part of this change. Our body needs to reflect kind of the changing face of Wichita as well. I guess otherwise we just kind of run the risk of just kind of backing ourselves into a corner and then, you know, getting to a point where we have nothing to say to our culture, nothing to say to the city of Wichita, and just kind of, well, we've got our small little group here, let's wait till we all get old and die, you know. I think we want to be relevant to the city of Wichita. We want to be able to work with the growing face of Wichita. And so I think this is something that we should all, you know, be concerned about. Not concerned in the sense of worried, but concerned in the sense of we want to be interested in this. This is something we want to take to heart, and we want to learn. We want to learn about. Just kind of going off that a little bit here as well, this was super non-scientific. So let me just put in Google Maps and see what I find kind of thing. So let me just see, like, how many churches, you know, of, I guess you could say immigrant communities are here in Wichita. Just a Google map search, I popped up 11 Spanish-speaking Protestant churches here in Wichita, plus pretty much every Catholic church, which does a mass in Spanish as well. Found churches that do services in Vietnamese, Laotian, Cambodian, Korean, and Mandarin, just in Wichita. You know, and I wouldn't consider Wichita the face of, you know, the a diverse cosmopolitan city as well. You know, so this is just here within Wichita. We've got, you know, there's quite a bit more diversity than I think that we would normally assume, and I think that we would like, you know, as a seed, we want to be relevant to this as well. So, all I was trying to say with that is that I think we can't really brush this under the carpet and say, well, this is happening on a global scale, doesn't affect us here in Wichita. It does affect us here in Wichita. So I'm going to kind of wrap things up a little bit. I'd love to have you in the class. I'm by no means an expert on any of this. Just something that interests me. Done a little research on it. And I think just be a great opportunity for just, you know, those who are interested, just to, I'm going to read through this and kind of just, you know, see how we can as the seed body kind of, you know, respond to this. You know, a great reason to take this class, obviously, is, you know, just if you have just strict curiosity. You know, another good reason I think to take the class is, you know, if you're, you know, you are interested in the seed church being relevant to a wider swath of the society and here in Wichita. I think, you know, honestly, another good reason to take this class is if maybe you're out there and you're kind of unsure about the whole Christianity thing. If you're kind of on the fence, you're like, I haven't 100% like bought into this. Like, I'm here because I know that there's something true going on here, but I'm not really to put up my hand and, you know, sink my teeth and throw my stock into Christianity. You know, I think it's also be a good class for you. I mean, I think there's no better way to really kind of sink your teeth into Christianity and just to see what it looks like all over the world, like from 2,000 years ago to now. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, when you start dating someone and then you get invited to the family reunion, you know, and you meet like drunk Uncle John and all this stuff. You're like, oh, this is what the family really looks like. You know, it's like, I mean, we're going to look at, you know, really what Christianity looks like all over. There's going to be a lot of, you know, very inspiring things, and there's going to be a lot of things like, this is muddy. Like, this is not like, I don't like this. So I think just a good reason to take the class is also if you're just, you know, kind of on the fence about this whole thing. And I say that because I think you'll find, I think you'd be encouraged just to find that, you know, there's not really a demographic of what Christians look like. Really, people from every culture have bought into Christianity. I think if we say that anything is objectively true, which we as Christians claim Christianity is, it's not something that works for us, that we like, but may not work for you. No, we're claiming this is objective truth, that this is right and everything else is wrong, which is a pretty big statement. If anything we claim is objectively true, then it obviously has to be objectively true everywhere. I can't say that, you know, blue is the best color. I can't make that objective truth because there's lots of people who's like, well, no, that's not right. That's just not true. I think if we find that, you know, people from every society, people that have nothing in common, have all bought into this. Today, 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, people that have had to really put up with a lot of garbage to claim Christianity, that have had just to put up with a lot of just hardship to say, yes, I'm a Christian. We kind of see that that is, you know, across the board, then, I mean, I think that gives some real credence to Christianity. This isn't just a thing we do in Kansas. This isn't just a Bible Belt Midwest kind of thing. Christianity really is a global force. It really is a thing that works and applies to every culture, every tradition. So if you're kind of on the fence about the whole Christianity thing, I definitely invite you to take the class as well. I think this will be a good way to kind of just, you know, really examine it for what it is and see like, hey, you know, I mean, this is bigger than just, you know, something that my mom drugged me to Sunday school when I was 11. This is a real thing. One last thing that I'll close and let the band come up. Just a couple little disclaimers. If you are interested in taking the class, like I said, we're going to be looking at a lot of different stuff. A lot of stuff that's just going to kind of be very wholly unfamiliar to our American Christian experience. So if you take the class, we're just going to have to do it with an open mind. And I think open mind is just kind of almost a buzzword for like, wait a minute. Does that mean we're just going to like everything we see like, this is wrong? No, that's just cultural. Well, this is obviously sin. No, it's not. No. We're obviously going to scrutinize everything we see in light of the Bible. We're also going to come across a lot of things that are just very different and very unfamiliar from our experience. So we have to just be able to, you know, read through this and just, you know, say, okay, well, Christ, is this real? Does this come out in your word? So we don't want to, at the same time, we don't want to be so pharisaical and locked down in what our traditions are and what our customs are and what our form of doing this is that we're completely blinded to see Christ moving in very big and powerful ways in other areas. So just one kind of disclaimer there. I mean, there's going to be a lot of stuff here that we're going to have to really just kind of hash through. I'm guessing there's going to be a lot of good, muddy conversation on as we read through some of this stuff. And number two, there's another small disclaimer. You know, this isn't really a class on missions either. You know, I think when we kind of think about global Christianity, I think our mind immediately kind of goes to, oh, well, sending out missionaries, right? That's kind of what. Not really, and this isn't really. We'll touch on it a little bit, and obviously, Western missions has had a huge role in the spread of Christianity around the world. But I mean, really, what we're seeing now is just a very, very different trend. We're seeing churches abroad that are, like I said, growing on their own and sustained on their own, and not tied to any, I would say, you know, Western Christian tradition at all. So. It's going to be, we'll have to go into it with obviously that mentality. Just because on a little side note, you know, I lived with my wife in the Dominican Republic for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years before we moved back here. And, you know, I knew dozens of believers, knew hundreds of believers, you know, went to dozens of churches. And I never knew any, like, missionaries there. I never knew any, like, Western mission. I mean, there's obviously, like, the week-long, you know, short-term mission groups that come down. But they would always come down and be hosted by, like, a Dominican church with the Dominican pastors. And, I mean, like, a holy Dominican, you know, body. So I think just as kind of just a short disclaimer throughout there, like, it's not really a class on missions. In fact, it's actually a chapter we're going to talk about. We're not really seeing it in the United States right now. We're definitely seeing it in Europe where it's kind of a reverse, that lots of places from Africa are starting to send missionaries into Europe because there just straight up aren't a lot of churches there. So just one other little disclaimer. I think we'll just conclude by reading just a great verse, Colossians 3:11. Charisse wants to throw it up there. And obviously, we know how this applies. I mean, this applies obviously to what we just read. Here there's not a Greek and Jew, circumcised and uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, free, but Christ is all and is in all. I guess as we go out, just really wanted to focus on that last little phrase there, but Christ is all and is in all. You know, if we identify ourselves as Christians, like any other category, demographic group that we fit into now sits underneath that. I'm no longer, I don't know, whatever I am. I am no longer someone from Kansas. I am no longer a Republican or a Democrat. I'm no longer black or white. I have all of these categories, but they are now all subservient to my definition, to my identity as a believer. I think it's just what he's saying there. Christ is all and is in all. This is our overarching defining characteristic now. And I think just because of that, we should be interested in letting all of these things in our society that are also kind of help to define us, to let all of that be subservient to Christ as well. We want to see that the Christian community here in Wichita and really abroad is, we can say with one voice that Christ is all and is in all. And this is the only thing that really defines us and drives us. So let's pray. Christ, we just really stand in awe of you. We just recognize that you are wholly bigger than we recognize and we understand. We just recognize that you, it's just really astound and shock and amaze us just in the ways that you choose to work, ways that we would not have planned or foreseen or anticipated. And we just thank you that you are not on our timetable, not on our schedules, not within our 10-year plan. We just want to worship you as a big God who is sovereign and is over all aspects of our life and all aspects of our society and over all aspects of our culture and all cultures. We just praise you because you are real, that you are not an invention of our minds, something that we have conjured up to make us feel better about ourselves, but you have revealed yourself to to men from the beginning of time, to men and women from the beginning of time up to now, Father, that you have made yourself known to all cultures, to all people, to all tongues and tribes. Just praise you for who you are. In your name we pray. Amen.